So lonely, so lonely and sadly alone. Dead no one, just me only, sitting on my little throne.
Kim Jong-il may be lonely in his hermit kingdom, but yesterday he got some rock star company when Bill Clinton came to town. The wheels had hardly touched down when Clinton was able to secure the release of reporters Laura Ling and Yuna Lee. Both are now headed back to Los Angeles.
Free at last, free at last. Thank God I'm on it, I'm free at last.
Well, free at last indeed, but we've still got some questions here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Oh, we've always got questions. Good morning. It's Wednesday, August 5th. I'm John Hockenberry, joined this morning by Amy Holmes all week. And we got a monster show this morning. Concealed weapons are a new fashion trend. It's a political story. Also, the economy and politics in Indiana. And do we need an excuse to talk about ice cream in the middle
Never.
Of the summer? No way.
But first, we have David Sanger, diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times, joining us from Washington. Welcome, David.
Morning.
So yesterday, Bill Clinton swooped in and swept out of North Korea. Was the outcome ever in doubt?
No, the outcome wasn't in doubt, Amy, but what was in doubt was what would happen between Bill Clinton and Kim Jong-il. Remember, Mr. Clinton was supposed to go visit Mr. Kim in the very last days of his presidency, and that was 9 years ago, and the dinner finally happened. What we don't know is what actually happened at it.
Well, David Sanger, we're going to find out. Stay with us. We'll continue the conversation, but first, the headlines.
Oh, fascinating stuff. In the headlines, while Bill is returning from North Korea, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is speaking out at a trade forum in Nairobi. She says democracy in Kenya must improve in order for business to grow. Moving to Pakistan, a suspected U.S. missile strike there has killed two people, including one of the wives of the Taliban leader Batula Masood. That's according to Pakistani intelligence officials. Amy?
In Iran, there are reports of clashes outside the swearing-in ceremony for the Iranian president's second term. Opposition supporters and riot police were gathered outside the parliament building where it took place. Back here in the United States, investigators are trying to figure out the motive of a gunman who fired dozens of shots in an L.A. fitness center in suburban Pittsburgh. He killed four people, including himself, and wounded nine others.
In California, a panel of federal judges has ordered the state's prison system to reduce its inmate population by 27% over the next 2 years. That's about 40,000 prisoners. The judges say it's the only way to improve California's prison system health care system. On Wall Street yesterday, markets were mostly flat. The Dow opens today at 9320. The broader S&P starts trading at 10.05. The NASDAQ opens at 2011, and futures trading suggests a negative opening when Wall Street gets started a few hours from now. So former President Clinton came to the rescue of two American journalists in North Korea. Should the office of former president be an official full-time job? Yes, there's president and there's former president. If so, what world problem needs a former president? Should we send Jimmy Carter? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Maybe it would be better to just run for former president.
I noticed you didn't mention George Bush.
Well, there's George Bush. Yeah, right. Interesting. Well, that's why we want you to call 8778-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Well, I knew something was positive was going to happen, and it happened. And I'm so glad, and I'm so thankful to the State Department. I'm very thankful for the government for doing all they can to gain the release.
That's one happy dad there, speaking on the release of his daughter, Laura Ling, along with journalist Yuna Lee. Both journalists are headed back to Los Angeles to everyone's great relief. I'm Amy Holmes, and I'm here with John Hockenberry. So, John, this seems like a well-rehearsed script,
right? Former president shows up, and the detainees are released. The script
almost
seems...
almost instantaneously.
Seems written by the North Koreans. It's kind of an old movie, but who did the casting? That's what I want to know.
Well, we're going to be asking that of David Sanger. He's here with us, chief Washington correspondent with the New York Times. He's been watching this story. So, David, President Clinton was in Pyongyang less than 24 hours. How did this happen?
It happened because the North Koreans, while sentencing the two reporters to one of their prison camps, you know, these famous gulags, in fact put them in a guest house near Pyongyang and let them talk to their families. The families did not broadcast this, obviously, and said to them, and then they told their families when they called in, that the North Koreans had specifically asked for Bill Clinton. Now, imagine... if you just run the clock back about 15 years to 1994, at the closest moment that we came since the Korean War to open conflict with North Korea over its nuclear program, it was Jimmy Carter who went in part representing Bill Clinton, but in part making the Clinton administration a bit unhappy for interfering with their diplomacy, and who brought about a temporary resolution. Well, now, fast forward, you've got the North Koreans asking for Clinton himself, now an ex-president, and, of course, a man who nearly went to North Korea as president in the very last weeks of his presidency, but they never quite pulled it off.
So, David, that raises the question, who's running the show here?
Well, in this case, clearly Kim Jong-il, who is ailing and who we think may not have a whole lot of time left, wanted his FaceTime with a former president, just as his father, Kim Il-sung, had FaceTime with Jimmy Carter.
So was this out of personal ego?
Kim Il-sung died just a month or so after that meeting.
So is this out of personal ego that he wanted Bill Clinton?
That could well be. I mean, you know, personal ego has a lot to do with it when you're discussing the leader of North Korea.
No kidding. So is this why Robert Gibbs, White House spokesman, said that Clinton did not carry a private message from Obama? What did he mean?
Well, I guess what he meant, and we've been trying to sort that out, is that he wasn't going to negotiate on the nuclear issue. But when they briefed us last night, they also told us that President Clinton and President Kim spent 3.5 hours together, a two-hour dinner and about an hour and a quarter of a meeting.
Interesting. Well, David, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be keeping our eye on this, and I'm sure we'll have you back.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, as David Sanger suggested there, there's a lot to talk about other than simply two American journalists detained in North Korea. The question is, did any of it come up in that meeting with Bill Clinton and Kim Jong-il? And the implications for other troubled U.S. relationships around the world certainly is part of the equation. And that was raised by Ambassador John Bolton, former ambassador to the United Nations, who had this to say about how North Korea might affect other relations between the United States.
In North Korea's mind, this was really two sides of the same coin. And that's why I worry about the precedent that's being set for a government like Iran that sees American hostages, nuclear weapons as all being part of a big strategic picture.
So does the situation in North Korea affect the situation in Iran? We should note this morning that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was officially inaugurated to his second term as the president of Iran, but it hardly ends the unrest that has marked the situation in Iran since the election of re-election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Joining us now is Shaul Bakhash, Clarence J. Robinson, professor of Middle East history at George Mason University in Virginia. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
First of all, what do you make of the connection? I mean, the Iranians seem to have a lot of problems right now. I don't know if they're necessarily looking at North Korea, but does action in North Korea suggest that Iran has some sort of action to take here? There are three Americans detained in Iran right now.
Yes, these three Americans were detained when they crossed the border into Iran while they were walking on the Iraqi side of the border, and it's still not clear what the Iranian government intends to do with them, to make a big issue of these arrests or to let them go.
So do you think that this encourages the Iranians in any way?
You mean President Clinton's visit
to
Korea? Well, it's hardly likely that a former president will visit Iran very soon, because relations really are much more strained right now, and Iran is undergoing great turmoil, but the same kind of problem of a nuclear program that the United States would like to see come to an end exists in Iran as in Korea.
Well, there was tough talk this morning from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as he took the oath of office in Iran. I wonder what you think a second term of Ahmadinejad might actually look like. And then I have some questions about the salience of the sort of issue of America the Great Satan in Iran. It seems like that issue is diluted at this point, at the very least. But first of all, a second Ahmadinejad term, what does that look like?
John, he took his oath of office under heavy guard, right? Police were out in the streets everywhere. Leading members of the opposition did not attend the inauguration ceremonies. So he takes office in an election that many Iranians think was illegitimate. He has increasingly to rely on force and repression. And even though he announced intentions to introduce reforms and a more prosperous economy, it seems hardly likely given the policies he pursued in the past, which were based more on the distribution of goodies rather than investing in productive programs. It seems hardly likely that his economic policy would change. So this is a much weakened president.
You know, we don't normally say that the beginning of a second term would be the end of an era or an epoch in Iran, but I'm wondering if we can actually make that claim this morning, because suddenly the issue of Iran being manipulated by external forces, a political issue that has been important in Iran since 1953 and certainly was reinvigorated after 1979, the Islamic Revolution, suddenly the issue of being manipulated by foreign powers, it seems very, very irrelevant to most of the concerns of Iranians, and that has to mark a historic turning point.
Well, clearly the government continues to try to blame the unrest in the country and the protests against the election on foreign manipulation, but no one in Iran believes that. And the president in his second term not only faces a discontented population at home, but a much diminished standing abroad. It's going to be much more difficult for the United States and the European countries to engage a president whose legitimacy at home is in question.
Professor Bakash, this is Amy Holmes here. Roger Cohen brings up an interesting possibility in the New York Times, that big New York Times piece that he wrote this Sunday, that in fact Ayatollah Khamenei can perhaps bring Iranian public opinion back behind him if some months from now he becomes conciliatory towards President Obama. That, getting back to John's point, it's hard to maintain the storyline of America the Great Satan when Obama has said he's willing to, you know, meet with no preconditions.
The supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has always been very skeptical about the benefits to Iran of engaging the United States, and I think his skepticism remains. Some analysts think, you know, a weakened government is much more likely to engage the United States as a way of winning back its legitimacy, and certainly that must be one of the courses the present government and regime are considering. But we don't yet see any easing of Iran's position vis-a-vis the United States or on the nuclear issue.
So let's talk about the nuclear issue then. If a weakened Iranian government is going to be more difficult to engage by the Americans and the Europeans, I mean, doesn't that make it at least possible for the Europeans and the Americans to put more pressure on Ahmadinejad to make some sort of accommodation? I mean, isn't it conceivable there could be a positive outcome here?
Well, President Obama is clearly still very focused on engaging Iran because he thinks the nuclear clock in Iran is ticking. And at the same time, the administration here has warned that if Iran does not satisfy demands that it curtail certain parts of its nuclear program, much more severe sanctions will be put
right
in place. The problem with sanctions is that they don't often work, and the problem with sanctions against Iran is that China and Russia are very reluctant
sure
to go along.
Well, Shaul Bakash, Clarence J. Robinson, professor of Middle East history at George Mason University in Virginia, helping us with a sort of Kremlinology approach to sorting out what's going on in Iran. There were many senior leaders not at the swearing-in of Ahmadinejad. Thank you so much, Professor.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.